Welcome to the How to Do Grad School podcast, where we talk with current and former graduate students about the habits, systems, and tools that they use to do great research. Our goal here, as always, is to learn tangible research skills from the people who have already figured them out on our way to becoming effective grad students and researchers. The following is my conversation with Carrie Wagstaff, a machine learning and artificial intelligence researcher at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and an associate research professor at Oregon State University. Carrie is a prolific researcher and an expert learner. Her career is an example of how awesome life can be when you love going to work and love the challenges you get to tackle every day. Talking to her made me feel much more optimistic about getting to shape my own research career, if I decide to go that route. And I hope it'll leave you with similar feelings. Enjoy this fascinating conversation with Carrie Wagstaff. Carrie, welcome to the How to Do Grad School podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thanks for agreeing to join us. The way I found you was through one of the previous guests on the show, Hannah Kerner, who I think you were one of her mentors. And I also realized that you had written this paper on constrained K-means clustering that I read a few weeks ago. And so I was like, oh, this is really cool. So I reached out. But that was, yeah, it was really cool to like see how small the world is and have all these ties. I thought we could start by just sort of learning a little bit about your background. So could you tell our listeners just like where you grew up, where you went to grad school, and kind of what you're up to now, as well as maybe some of the research areas that you're interested in?
Sure, yeah. I grew up in rural Utah, and I went to the University of Utah to study computer science. And that's where I first was exposed to research projects through, in that setting, natural language processing work in AI. And then I went off to grad school at Cornell University in Ithaca and continued pursuing natural language processing and machine learning topics and bringing those together. And actually the constrained clustering work you mentioned is an example of that, because I was working on how can you make clustering algorithms more tailored to a particular problem or domain. And one of the application areas was looking at coreference resolution for natural language processing. But at the same time, I also was able to apply it to data from the Hubble Space Telescope and observations of Mars. And Mars and planetary science has been an interest of mine for a really long time. And so after getting my PhD, I spent a year at the Applied Physics Laboratory in Maryland, working in their space department on, again, applying machine learning methods to space exploration topics. And then transitioned over to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where I've been since 2003, and working in that general area, looking specifically at how can you use machine learning to help both with analysis of massive data archives that we're collecting from our space missions, but also how can you put it out on the frontier on board a spacecraft, a rover, or an orbiter, where you're in a really constrained computing environment, but you don't have direct access to humans. So the ability to encode some of those intelligent behaviors into the spacecraft can be a huge benefit for collecting data that is of value. Or deciding if you collect a lot of data, but you can only send back, say, 10 images, which 10 will be the ones that humans would most like to see and learn from. That's been my main focus there. And then I'll just add, a couple of years ago, I moved up here to Oregon, where I am now, and I also have a position at the Oregon State University, mainly for teaching and for connecting with students and doing research with folks here too. And teaching has been an interest of mine for a very long time, so it's nice to get to indulge in that.
Yeah, that's really awesome. The research sounds really, really cool. And I'm probably going to ask about some of it, but I might not get into a lot of the nuts and bolts, but I'm really interested. So maybe I'll actually look up some of and read some of those papers that I saw on your website. But to kind of start off, one of the sort of most fascinating things, I think, and kind of just out of left field for me, that sort of stood out to me while I was doing some research, was that you won the 2017 Adult Spelling Bee.
That's right.
And I didn't even know that there was an Adult Spelling Bee, so I was really surprised to find that out. I was just curious how you got into doing that.
I had learned about this event a few years before that. And it's kind of funny because it is the National Adult Spelling Bee, but it's held in California. And although people come from all over the country, I think it's dominated by California participants just for convenience. And yeah, I thought, I haven't done a spelling bee since I was a kid. Surely that would be fun to try as an adult, right? And so I went to it and did not win. And then it became kind of an annual thing. And you kind of, there's a group of people who participate in this. You get to know them. And the same people like to come and compete every year. And then in 2017, I won. So yeah, it was fun.
Incredible. That was just awesome. Awesome, awesome, awesome. I might try to do that in the future if it's still around.
Yeah, why not, right? It's a fun thing. It's people who love words. It's people who love challenging themselves. You know, it's a great community. And it's also a charitable event, so there's a lot of good aspects to it.
Oh, didn't know that. Didn't know that. That's awesome. I'll definitely look more into it. So I know that you mentioned you are a researcher at NASA JPL and have been there for some time now, and now also a research professor at Oregon State. So you've been in research for some time, and I kind of wanted to like sort of frame our research conversation from some of the like threads that I picked out from learning about your research and how I think that you approach it. And, you know, this might be sort of just my lens, and you can correct me where I made any errors, but I think there's sort of like three things that I wanted to pick out. And one is just like this learning, like sort of constant learning that it seems like you're doing all the time. And then another is writing and how you get better at writing and communicating research. And then the last one is sort of the collaboration piece, because it seems like you collaborate with a lot of other researchers in your work. So starting with the learning piece, definitely from just kind of looking into the things that you're doing, I got the sense that you're an avid and general learner. I mean, sort of the spelling bee is one example of that. I actually imagine that this is how you get a lot of ideas for research, because I think something that I found is that the more I read, the more ideas get populated and cross-pollinated. But there's also like a sort of a catch-22 here, because there's sort of like endless things you can learn about. So can you talk about how you decide what you should be learning about and what kind of things you sort of need to go deeper into at any specific moment in time?
Sure. I think there may be kind of two categories there, where there's things you sort of need to learn, background knowledge you need to acquire, or what is the state of the art in such and such area to enable you to move forward or to tackle a problem that you're working on. And then there's the sort of curiosity-driven aspect, where maybe you don't need that information to solve a specific problem, but you just find it captivating. And it, you know, you're curious, so you want to know more. And I was like knowing how things work at some level, whether that's taking apart the alarm clock or it's, you know, reading, just doing some background reading in astronomy or whatever it is. I like to know details when I'm working on something. I feel like that helps me feel more confident about what I'm doing, that it's on a firm basis. And a lot of it leads into actually your third point about collaboration. So in many times I'm working with domain experts from astronomy, cosmology, or planetary science, geology, these other areas that, you know, I can't know everything that's there, but I want to know enough that we can have an intelligent conversation and that their priorities can ground whatever work we're doing to do this application of machine learning to a problem of their interest. So I enjoy getting pointers to go off and learn about some part of the science that relates to the project we're working on. But in terms of even outside of work, it's definitely been just curiosity driven. For example, I've been volunteering at the local library for several years, and I just became more and more interested in, okay, how do you organize a library? How do you set that up? How do you make that work? How do you staff it? What are the procedures? How do you acquire new books? Which books should you get? All these questions just kept coming up. And so that inspired my interest in the library science degree. And it's fascinating, coming from a computer science perspective, how some of the same topics come up, because you're talking about information and management, but in very different ways and with a different ultimate goal. In computer science, we're often exploring the frontier. We want to understand how, again, how things work, or the limits of information and automation. And in library science, the ultimate goal is service. So it's all about, okay, how can you take what you've learned and make that useful for somebody, solve their problem, meet their information need? And the cultural differences are fascinating. So that's just one example, but
yeah.
But great question. There is a challenge in how do you prioritize, because we don't have infinite time to go off and read books and take classes and learn things. So I think that's a very personal decision about where are you going to put your time?
Yeah, I really like that structure of that two-part learning. So there's some things that you have to learn, and then you should also just be learning to fulfill your curiosity and to explore. And I think that the interplay between those is kind of probably where the formation of I saw this thing and something I was just interested in, and it kind of applies to, my research area. So the library science is a great example of this computer science. And
And exactly what you said earlier too about it inspiring new ideas. So my master's thesis for the library science degree was focused on, of course, using machine learning to solve a problem, which specifically was, how do you decide which books are old enough or are no longer of interest to be discarded? Because nobody likes to throw away books, but in a finite library system, and you want to bring in new things all the time, you have to make decisions about what should be kind of phased out to make room for new materials. And that is a hard problem. And anything that can help automate the decision process, or at least come up with recommendations, can help save a lot of human time. And so for me, that was bringing together these two areas, but I never would have thought that that was even a problem of interest until I'd spent time in that community.
Hmm. Just out of curiosity, how did you, high level, how did you solve that problem? Was it kind of mostly just looking at frequency of things being checked out, or how did you approach that?
the circulation records are a major part of that, but there's also interesting factors like the quality of the item, how many other copies you have of that item, because, you don't need to keep all 10 maybe, but you want to keep one. Mm-hmm. And so there's some interesting dependencies between individual items. And also, is it available through interlibrary loan from a partner library? Even if you don't keep a copy, maybe they'll have one that's accessible for your community. But it's a matter of having sufficiently described each of those items so that you can do some kind of reasoning about their properties.
Yeah.
And there's another interesting angle there. Are you trying to train a model to make the optimal decision, whatever that is? Or are you trying to train a model to replicate what a human librarian has done in the past? And the second one is much easier to define, right? Because who knows what the optimal model even would be. And it depends on your user or client community, what materials they need access to and what to preserve. So there's not a generic rule that applies for every library. And I think it makes sense to use machine learning to tailor it for this library's priorities and community, and then you could adapt it for other ones.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's really awesome. And going back to this learning, and it's sort of related to what you just kind of talked about with this master's thesis, I kind of envisioned that I will sort of also continue to learn things after my PhD, just because I'm curious. But I kind of always thought that, after I'm done with my PhD, I'm sort of done with degrees, right? And so I kind of figured I'd be, self-learning by, reading all kinds of books or maybe taking some free online courses. But you have enrolled in these sort of specialty master's degree programs to get a more formalized education on these topics. So can you talk about some of the benefits of enrolling in degree programs, what those have been for you, especially kind of at a time where it sort of feels where information is everywhere. We should be able to learn everything on the internet. We probably don't even need colleges anymore. So those kinds of things for you.
That's right. Sure. To me, I think, again, we talked about priorities earlier already, but it can be hard to even decide where to start or what pieces you want to put together to learn something. And so one obvious benefit of a structured program is someone has already figured that out for you. At least they've come up with, these are the core things you should know to have a good background in this domain. And they've even usually chained them together in a prerequisite form. So start here and then go there. Makes it a lot easier than you trying to sift through all the topics and kind of decide what needs to be covered, aside from just random curiosity, which is also a good thing. So having that structure is good. And of course, the accountability of an actual course with assignments, projects, exams, course group work with other people in the class as well. That really keeps you moving forward, not just it being a side thing when you can find time for it. So I think it gives you a level of commitment that's helpful too. But I will say I also really enjoy Coursera courses and other less structured settings too. I don't feel like the only way, I certainly don't feel the only way that you can learn is through a degree program. And typically the main benefit people want there is it's a credential so that they can qualify maybe for a new occupation or something like that. And that has value too. But for me, it was really just having the structure because you're coming into an area where maybe you don't even know what the core elements that need to be covered would be. It gives you confidence that you're on the right track.
Yeah, you don't even know like what you should be learning kind of. Yeah. So I really like
that. It's helpful, but I don't think it's necessary, certainly. So yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if there, I mean, this is kind of just thinking out loud. I wonder if there's models that can, you know, people are learning a lot of things on YouTube, but like, are there ways that we can create curriculums on YouTube or like things like that? But yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. And I will say that what you voiced earlier, I've heard and felt this too, that, well, you work through your undergraduate, maybe master's degree, PhD, then you're done, right? You're done. You can be free. You can go work, whatever. And it actually took me a while to figure out that, no, that it's up to you how you want to structure that. It does not have to be the end point, which is kind of cool. And a model that I've encountered that I actually wish we had more in our field is when I started taking pilot flying lessons. In the flying world, you work all your way up, you solo your airplane, and then you finally get your pilot certificate, which means you are now legally allowed to fly an airplane. And literally nobody views that as an endpoint. It's an interesting culture. They say that your pilot certificate is a license to learn. And I've heard this before in other contexts, but they actually mean it. So after you get that base level, there's all these endorsements you can add for high altitude, for instrument flying, for commercial flying, for high performance engines. There's this laundry list of additional things you can add depending where you want to go with your flying. But there is an expectation and actually a biennial requirement that you demonstrate that you have the skills, that you're continuing to learn and continuing to keep that sharp. And I like that that's embedded in that culture. And I feel like we could have more of that in the research world too. And to some extent we do, if you build that into your practice of there's whatever conference that you attend every year, you're going to learn something from that. Maybe you're presenting something at every time you go. But we don't think of it formally as a commitment, like I'm going to keep doing this because it benefits me and it keeps me sharp, you know? So I really like that model of there's an expectation you don't just kind of stop and sit on your laurels, but there's always more to learn.
Yeah, I could ask so many questions about that. I'm really curious about the pilot license now, but I'll save those for maybe another time. So in terms of writing, so as researchers, we have to write a bunch. And I think it seems like the best, or at least the most seasoned writers write beyond their work and their papers, which it seemed like you certainly do. I actually ran into your blog called What I Learned Today. And I actually discovered something that was really useful, the Kindle highlights, that you sort of have this repository online of all your Kindle highlights. I'll probably link that in the show notes so people can take a look at that. But I was like, oh my gosh, all the library books I've ever read, all the highlights are there. It's amazing. but from that lens, just kind of about writing, can you talk about the evolution of your writing and maybe frame it in the context of like, what do you think you know now about, you know, writing papers or other kinds of content that feels different from like what you knew 5 years ago or even a year ago, if you can't go that far back?
Sure. This is a great topic. I feel like specifically when I started grad school, I thought I was a pretty good writer. You know, I'd had essays and things assigned in classes before, and I'd done quite a bit of writing in what I considered, you know, an academic context. And then when I sat down to write my first research paper to submit to a conference, I wrote what I thought was an appropriate draft. And then I had the fortune of my advisor being an excellent technical writer. I don't know if everyone can say that, but she is just phenomenal. And so she took my draft, she completely reorganized it, and actually took the time, because she knew it was my first conference paper, to go through many drafts. And I learned so much from her red pen. She had this amazing ability to take an entire paragraph that I had written and condense it into one sentence that had all the ideas very crisply and clearly. And I felt like just seeing that before and after, I was learning so much from her example, because, you know, if you read a paper, you're just seeing the final product. You don't really see how it got there. And I'm still grateful that I had that experience, that I had a very skilled editor and writer guiding me to figure out this is the kind of language format that we use in this kind of writing. And as everyone will tell you, you know, extensive reading in that area will give you that sense gradually. You'll start picking up the language and the process. And very importantly, you'll pick up the kind of structure of a paper in that field, right? And at this point, I almost feel like I have a mental template for, I have an idea, okay, here's exactly how I'll lay it out, because this is how it's done. And this is what people expect. This is be easy for them to understand the idea I'm trying to share. But you don't have that when you're starting out. So it just has to be acquired. There are a lot of people who advocate for, you know, writing 15 minutes a day or something like that, just to keep articulating your thoughts. And I love this idea, and I've never been able to put it into practice. So I think it makes a lot of sense, though. The thing I do is I try to really write early. Like before, you know, we have a tendency to want to finish whatever the project is and then write it up. And I try not to do that, because I have found so many times that just as I'm writing out what I think the logical flow of the idea will be, it exposes these gaps or incompletely thought out pieces that it's better to discover now than 2 minutes before the deadline or something, right? And you can even share that narrative form of your paper, just the idea, with other people for sanity check. So I'm a big fan of that. The other thing I like to use when writing papers is, again, even maybe before I even write the paper, on the whiteboard or a piece of paper, I sketch out a figure or the figure or whatever of what I think would be like the poster child result that I want to convey. We're going to be looking at performance as a function of runtime, and it's going to look like this, you know. And I might be totally wrong. And if you're wrong, actually, that's very illuminating. But it helps articulate what you think, where you think this is going, and what you think would be the most compelling demonstration to support it. Because once you've done all the experiments and work, it's kind of hard to pull together into a concrete, you know, what's the key thing. But if you have that idea in advance, it can actually help with your decisions about methodology. What data sets do I need to really explore that idea to get to that figure? Mm-hmm. How many do I need? How many data points do I, you know? So you don't have to wait till the end when you've finished all of the work is how I've tried to adapt my paper writing process.
Yeah. Yeah. So I heard a few things that I'll sort of pick out for the audience here. So one is sort of this simplicity and clarity. So taking paragraphs and turning them into sentences. And then another thing that I heard was sort of this importance of audience. So reading to get a sense of who your audience is in the field. And maybe even, you know, if you're not sort of writing for research, there's probably still an audience that you're writing to. And there's probably other people that write to that audience. And so reading to sort of get a sense of like how they communicate with that audience. And then this sort of like idea of writing to think as you go helps you clarify your ideas, creating plots that you might want to see or that you hypothesize you'll see. Okay. Yeah, I think I'm going to take some of that too and implement it. I think this 15 minutes a day thing is also something that I've struggled with and haven't been able to do, but aspire to as well. But yeah, I think there's a lot of good in there that like I think I can glean and a lot of people can glean from and try to implement into their writing practices.
That's a great distillation. I guess one other thing I might note is that I tend to write the abstract for a paper last. I don't know if that's something you do as well. It comes first in the paper, so it's staring you in the face and it's tempting to try to write it. But I find that by the time I finish the paper, it's often kind of out of date and it doesn't say it as crisply. Now that I have the whole paper, I have the big picture. Now I can pull out the five things I really want to get into the abstract or whatever. And so I just put it aside and I come back to it at the very end.
Yeah, I actually really like that because I don't do that, but I sort of feel the pressure of like the sunk cost once you've already written it. And like, you know that the paper is different at the end, but you're trying to preserve some of the original abstract that you wrote. And so there's a little bit of sunk cost. So if you just ignore the abstract at the beginning, then there's no feeling of sunk cost. So I really like that actually a lot.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Maybe even the introduction.
And the introduction too, that can also benefit often from writing it late in the process, even though it comes early in the paper. So yeah.
The sort of third thing I wanted to touch on was this collaboration piece. And so for you, especially, you know, working on these large teams of other scientists who are, as you sort of mentioned, maybe experts in fields that you're not an expert in, I think it's really clear that, especially for things like planetary science and really big challenging things for us as humans, you need to sort of work with other people to accomplish those things. I think little is understood about how to do it well, how to like work well with others that you don't necessarily interact with on a daily basis. So whenever you have like a good collaboration that works out really well, what do you think are like sort of the key elements of like those teams that make them work well together?
That's a great question in general. I've had some pretty varied experiences at JPL because most of my work in the research area is with relatively small teams. I would say 3 to 5 people, maybe 10 max. And that leads to a more intimate connection. So you can really get to know people and make sure that everyone has the chance to say something during a meeting. It's not like you've got 100 people. And so I think that makes it a little bit easier. Also, man, all the colleagues that I've had the chance to work with at JPL and other places, I've been so impressed by. It's just been a really positive experience in general that makes things easy. So these small research tasks where we have maybe a weekly meeting and we touch base or maybe by email, it seems to just work well when you have the right people with the right expertise. But something that always helps is, of course, having really clearly defined roles, even in a small team, who's in charge of what. So you don't have people wasting time kind of trying to solve the same problem, but not knowing that someone else was already working on it, which can be frustrating. But also making sure that everything is covered too. And that piece actually scales up even for the larger projects. The largest group I worked on was with the Opportunity Rover team. So that was not in a research context. It was rover operations, where every day you're just coming up with a plan for what the rover's going to do, what pictures it will take, where it's going to drive. And that involves many, many people. And I came into that mission when they were already, I think, 8 or 10 years in. So I just had to admire. They had this well-oiled machine. They truly had optimized the roles and positions. Everyone knew exactly what they were doing. And the level of trust and respect between all of the people working was phenomenal. In a space mission like that, you need people with engineering expertise relating to hardware and software and the nitty-gritties of how the rover is operating. And you need people with the high-level science vision that tell you what you're even there for. And in some places, there can be cultural conflicts between people who are more engineering and science-focused. And that mission is kind of legendary for having solved that. And that I came in after they've already, you know, built this very friendly environment, but I had to admire how I saw it too, that there was respect in both directions and that's why it was so successful. Yeah. So having the right roles, but having respect for all of the roles and not dismissing the utility of like the people who are testing your code, not just the people who are writing it and all of the pieces that go into it.
Yeah. And when you were talking about that, it sort of reminded me of like sports teams, like the best sports teams, like they have clearly defined roles. Like you kind of know your role on the team and you do your job because your job is really important and you know your job is really important. And so you do your job really well and you don't worry about, you know, being the star player or being the person who scores the most points, but you sort of just do your job. And so I think there's certainly an analogy there of like just having clearly defined roles that people buy into and love doing their job.
Yeah. And I think also making it clear from the start, if there's any hierarchy or if there isn't, and sometimes it's helpful when there isn't, right? Like maybe there's always like a principal investigator for a project, but the way that person adopts that role influences the entire team, whether they are kind of dictatorial or whether it's a more collegial, it's a team, we're truly working together.
Absolutely. And just out of curiosity, you know, how do you sort of personally keep track of long-term projects? Like, I imagine you're on sort of multiple teams, maybe at the same time. Do you have like a project management system that you use? Or could you give us an example of like how you think about that?
This is a continual challenge. I have tried out some various software solutions for this exact thing, and I still haven't found the key thing that will solve everything. At this point, most of my projects, we use a whole lot of GitHub. We use issues, and they have a project feature there where you can group issues together to make that not just one long list of things to do, but actually grouped by meaning. I find that helpful, but that doesn't give you so much of the longer term, what are the big milestones and what's the timeline we're aiming for. So I do a lot of whiteboarding for that. So I don't have a tool I would point to that solves us. And I actually am continually interested in hearing recommendations on exactly this issue. But I would say mostly we tend to use Slack for really quick questions, like help me solve this and this is broken or I need that thing, or quick questions. And email for anything that needs to be archival that you want to be able to search later or document a little bit more. And then GitHub for the to-do, bugs, code updates, and so on. But that's pretty mechanical. That doesn't give you the high-level project view that you're pointing out is so important.
Yeah, I mean, there's aspects of that, you know, create sort of some kind of system. And at least, like, it's important to, like, yeah, have some thoughtfulness around it. And it sounds like there is some thoughtfulness about how, you know, things, how the work is being done. So I think that's probably the most important thing rather than, like, a particular tool or another.
Yeah, and for most of our projects, they are associated with some kind of proposal. It's not just completely undirected, right? So you have to do the upfront thinking about where you want to be at the end and what are the steps. And so I use that as a guide. But with the knowledge that research has to be flexible, it's not deliver this product and ship on this date, right? It's you're asking questions to which the answers are not known. It could take you in a new direction. You could reprioritize. And I like to keep that in mind, that a flexibility is actually a part of the research practice. So you don't want to lose sight of your goal, but you also don't want to be slavishly doing steps that no longer make sense.
So I wanted to give you an opportunity to maybe talk about one of the sort of most exciting things that you feel like you're working on now. So just to kind of nerd out a little bit and hear a little bit more about some of the stuff that you're doing, what is one of the most exciting projects that you think you're working on now?
Yeah, so a really fun one that I'm working on right now is called the Mars Target Encyclopedia. So the idea is that we've had decades of exploration of the surface of Mars, and being humans, we like to be able to refer to specific interesting features that we see, or specific rocks, formations, or other features on the surface. So we give them names. And so far, we as a community have been giving them names that don't reflect anything about their composition or nature. It's just, oh, we need a new name. And so a lot of Earth names get reused of people, places, animals, science fiction characters. You know, it has nothing to do with the Mars rock that you're trying to talk about, but it needs a name. So we give them names. And then later, you as a researcher might want to know, well, what's everything that's ever been known about a rock called John Klein? Which is actually a name of a target on Mars, as well as a person. And finding that is almost impossible. Even if you do a keyword search, these names are just not unique enough, or you can't really assemble them. So we're using information extraction tools to mine through the planetary science literature and pull out everything that's known about these Mars targets of interest that have been named, and put it in one database where you can actually find out what are all of the discoveries that have been made about that rock? And it traces it back to the actual literature where that information came from. So I think it has the potential to really transform how planetary science research is done, not only to say, what's everything known about this rock and its composition, but it can expose things that haven't been characterized yet. You can see the big negative space, right, in this database where things haven't been filled in. And that can lead to, was that not filled in because, yeah, it wasn't very interesting? Or we ran out of time on that mission. But if we had time, that would be a high priority. So it can actually guide decisions about where to explore in the future.
That's awesome. And is the idea to sort of auto-update the encyclopedia?
Yeah. So as new papers are published, you feed them into this information extraction process that takes a PDF, extracts text, and then runs it through named entity recognition, relation extraction, and turns it into facts, basically, properties of these targets that get stored in the searchable database.
Very, very cool. That's Wikipedia for Mars.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, with the analysis on top of it. We've been able to generate really cool products, too, that then you can take, for example, a map of Mars that the rover drove on this traverse and say, where did it find calcium? And you can highlight all the places where it's been published that these targets contained calcium. So you can also see the spatial distribution of these discoveries.
Wow, that's awesome. I kind of just really get the sense that you love going to work every day because the problems that you're working on are just really, really cool. So we're coming up on time, and I have one final question, and that is reaching back to your grad school days to close out the episode here. So what do you think were some of the most important things that you, or maybe one important thing that you did in your PhD that prepared you for your work now, or maybe, you know, something that you feel is still having an impact on how you think now that you sort of recognize during your PhD?
Oh, that's a really good question. I will say things in the field of AI and machine learning have evolved a lot since I was in graduate school, and it's been amazing to observe that. So when I started grad school, at least where I was going to grad school, AI was kind of on the side. It was not the superstar of the department in any way. It was the kind of a niche thing that some people were doing. And that meant that, yeah, it felt really free to pick a topic. There was just a lot to investigate, a lot of things that were not known. And that's still true. But nowadays, it seems that everybody wants to do it. And it's a very competitive environment. And I almost don't recognize that when I talk to folks who are applying now for grad school in machine learning or AI. It is a crazy, crazy place now. And I think I welcome the fact that I had the space to explore and work with people in many different areas in grad school and not feel maybe that I had to quickly converge and quickly pick something and be the best. And it just didn't seem as competitive or cutthroat as what I'm hearing now. But I think that in any graduate school experience, the biggest takeaway is that you aren't alone there. Even if you're the only one working on constrained clustering in your department or whatever, the only grad student working on that. I got a lot out of the other students that also worked with my advisor, but also with others in NLP and machine learning, because it felt like we were in it together, that we were pursuing the same ultimate goal of, can we push knowledge forward? And we would read each other's drafts of papers and things like that. And I think I benefited a lot from that. I ended up getting a thesis buddy, actually. I actually recommend this for everybody, who wasn't even going to my school. She was at UMass, but we were about at the same stage when we were writing our dissertations. And we would send chapters back and forth, and we weren't even working on the same topic at all. But knowing that somebody other than my advisor was actually going to read this really helped me focus on my writing and put a lot into it and know that, yeah, it wasn't just going into a void. I think having something like that, so, and again, accountability, right? Oh, I need to send this chapter by the end of the week, so I can't just wait to the end of the year and come up with a whole dissertation. That was a really good lesson for me. And I try to do that now, even to send drafts or parts of papers to colleagues who aren't working on the project, and try to get their feedback too.
Yeah, that's a really great idea that I'm definitely going to borrow because I will be deserting pretty soon too. So I'll definitely try to use that. Well, yeah, I think I agree with a lot of what you said there.
Yeah, because that final dissertation writing can feel very isolating, I think, for a lot of people. And so anything you can do to make it more like you're not just the only person who cares about this work is very helpful.
Yeah. And I really sort of like the sentiment that you shared about just in general, not even just in CS, but like in a lot of, I feel like academia has become really competitive. and less collaborative. And so I think we're kind of all in our own silos. And yeah, I don't think I've ever read a draft of another PhD student's like paper in my time as a PhD student. So that just seems foreign to me. But yeah, it seems like a reasonable thing to do, right? So
yeah, and sometimes just getting that started can be like, if you volunteer to read someone else's work, almost anybody would be grateful for that, right? That you would take the time to give them some feedback and then they might return the favor to you.
Definitely some things to try. Well, thank you so much again for making the time. I think this has been a really informative conversation, and it's been really informative for me to kind of look through your work. And I think I can definitely say, like, I'm a fan of yours. I don't know if that's like the sort of right framing of it, but I think that, you know, just like even the sort of information that is available for just people to learn from on your website, it was just like a really, really awesome experience. And so I think I'm definitely going to continue to learn more about what you're doing and keep an eye on the stuff that you're doing and try to learn from it as I go along.
Well, I'd love to hear more from you about it and about your work too.
Thank you for listening to the How to Do Grad School podcast. If you liked this episode, share it with someone in grad school or someone thinking about going to grad school. You can leave us feedback or recommendations on our website, howtodogradschool.com with the number 2, or you can DM us on Twitter at htdgs. We'll be back with a brand new episode in 2 weeks. See you then.